In 1912, more than 1,000 black citizens were driven out of Forsyth County near North Georgia. Whites shot their pets, burned their homes, and threatened further violence if anyone tried to stay.
My dad said that every black person had to leave. They had to be gone before 12 o'clock midnight. Everybody.
That was Forsyth County descendant Lily Nash. Author Patrick Phillips has written a new history of Forsyth County. It's called Blood at the Root. And he joins us now via Skype. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. I wanted to kind of figure out where the book for you actually began, because it looks like two events occurred. One, you saw this black and white photograph that seemed to have an incredible impact on you. And also your friend, the poet Natasha Trethewey, told you to write about issues that affect race from the white perspective. Did those both come at relatively similar times?
Well, really, one came after the other. I had a conversation with Natasha. We're old friends. And she really, I tell the story in the book of how she really challenged me to turn and tell this story. Natasha went to the University of Georgia, so she knew a little bit about the legend of Forsyth. And so she really confronted me at one point very kindly and in a friendly way, but she seemed to give me both permission and also, I think, a real obligation to try to learn more about this story. So in the wake of that conversation, I started looking into the archives. You know, a lot of things have been digitized in the last 15 years, and I was astonished to find a photograph of the prisoners who were arrested in 1912 in Forsyth at the real outset of this racial cleansing. So when I first looked at that photograph and first really looked into the faces and into the eyes of the people involved, the whole, what had been told to me as a myth and a legend, suddenly became very real, and I became very committed to trying to find out the real story of what happened.
And, you know, it's interesting that because you said you heard about it as a myth and a legend, and at one point in the book you say when you went to college you would retell the story to Northerners who enjoyed it. You said because, quote, the story fit every stereotype they'd ever heard about the South. What did you hear about this when you were growing up?
Well, one of the things I heard was that this was the work of the Ku Klux Klan, right? And so I learned this story when I was 7 years old. My parents moved from Sandy Springs in Northside, Atlanta, to up to Lake Lanier and into Forsyth County in 1977 when I was a seven-year-old. So my first experience of the story was just something that kids said on the playground, something that kids said in the back of the school bus. And it all sounded very mythic and legendary. And in my mind, I pictured white sheeted knight riders, you know, on horseback with torches doing this. What I found when I started looking into it is that, of course, the Ku Klux Klan was not reconstituted until 1915.
Yeah, it didn't exist in 1912.
It did not exist in 1912 and had really been prosecuted out of existence in the 1870s. So I had to let go of this old image, which I think was also probably something that helped protect whites in Forsyth from really facing the involvement of their own ancestors in these events. Because if it seemed like the Klan, it was this monstrous other kind of force. And then what I found once I realized that the Klan didn't even exist in 1912 was a letter from a woman who was 14, Ruth Jordan. When she was 80 years old, she wrote down her memories of that time. And in the letter, she says, quote, it weren't the Klan that did this. It was just ordinary people of the county. So that, you know, that was a find that really altered my whole idea of what went on.
As you read the book, and the book is outstanding.
Thank you.
It sounds as though there were a lot of sort of reality checks for you along the way. And we don't have time, and I would want people to read the book to really walk through the chronology of how this all happened. But simply speaking, a young woman was found mortally injured. She later died. It sounds as though they immediately looked for basically the closest African-American person, arrested a number of people, and then that turned into them driving every black citizen out of Forsyth. Why?
Well, you know, there was a real wave of paranoia and fear. And I think that obviously some deep-seated racism and bigotry was already present in the county. But the immediate environment was just paranoia and fear among the white community that there was a black rebellion underway. And the newspapers played a role in this. They reported on fiendish black rapists at large in the county. And as a result, on the night that this woman, May Crow, was buried, bands of white men set out and used dynamite, arson, shotguns. They fired into sharecroppers' cabins. And one of their main methods was they set fire to black churches. Within the first couple of weeks, there were reports in the papers, and a letter was written to the governor warning that the mobs had set fire to five black churches in the county.
And they basically took just took everything, took land, repurposed even crops, took it in. And there's this one just kind of stark memory of a young, well, she was young at the time, Helen Matthews Lewis.
Yeah, that's
and,
right.
Yeah. Could you tell me about what she describes? Because she's talking about walking to a friend's door and then stopping to look down at the paving stones. What did she see there?
Yeah, she lived in the county in the 1930s and 40s. And when she was a senior in high school at Forsyth County High, she shortly before she moved out of the county, she was walking up to a friend's door, and she noticed inscriptions on the stones on the pathway leading up. And when she bent down and looked, she said that she realized that these were headstones from a black cemetery, and that someone had dug them up and used them as flagstones.
So all of this would have been really past history. I mean, 1912 is not that long ago in the history of human the race, but it is, you know, more than 100 years ago now. However, what you describe in your book is how that the all white Forsyth County was enforced, and sometimes with violence and threats of violence, including an attempted murder in 1980. What happened to Miguel Marcelli?
Miguel Marcelli was a firefighter in Atlanta, a city of Atlanta firefighter who had been born in the Virgin Islands. So he was an African-American man, but he did not know about the history of the county. And so he came up to a company picnic up on the lake with his girlfriend, and the two of them soon realized that there was a very threatening atmosphere. There were whites kind of coming by this park where they were and leering at them and very frightening. And so they tried to leave the park, and on their way out of the park, a man named Melvin Crow and two of his friends pursued them and really kind of stalked them. And Miguel Marcelli was shot in the neck. And, you know, he barely survived this shooting, which was really just in a punishment for the nothing other than the fact that he had crossed the county line and had crossed over this unwritten racial line.
And 1980 is very recent history. After that, in we get to the peace march, and we have about a minute left. Can you tell us about the inspiration for the peace march? Why did marchers decide to walk through Forsyth County?
It was the 75th anniversary of the, you know, 1912 to 1987 meant 75 years had passed since these events, since the racial purge and the racial ban, and a white man in the county joined forces with Hosea Williams and protesters from the King Center in Atlanta to have what was called a Brotherhood March. This is the best known part of the story, and many listeners may remember this. And it was a very modest plan to walk about 2 miles along a country road and simply speak out for peace and brotherhood and an end to the 75 years of intimidation. And they were met by what quickly turned into a mob of whites. 7 of the 8 people who were arrested were people with Forsyth County addresses.
And the reason that's important, we're going to explain in just a moment. I'm speaking with Patrick Phillips. His book is called Blood at the Root. It talks about the racial purge that happened in Forsyth County more than a century ago and the all-white nature of the county that sustained ever after that. Patrick, I want to play this clip now from the documentary about this issue. The documentary is called Banished, and the voice that we're about to hear is Carl Dickerson.
This is my grandmother. Her name was Maddie Bell Black, that had to leave from Forsyth County. They came to him and said, all of you got to go tonight, you know. Got to get out of here tonight, or we're going to kill you.
Okay, so right before we took a break, you were saying that 7 of the 8 people arrested during that peace march in 1987 had addresses in Forsyth County. Why is that an important distinction to make?
I think that's significant because for so long in Forsyth, there's been a desire to distance the local community there from these events, going all the way back to 1912. In 1912, in the newspapers, there were frequent quotes from residents of the county saying, well, the Knight Riders were all from up in the hills. They all came from somewhere else. And there's really a century of that in the newspaper records of people wanting to suggest this was the work of the Klan or this was the work of outside agitators of some kind. And the reality is, I think those denials have played a role in perpetuating this and the way that it's been passed down generation to generation.
So, in fact, 1987, Cumming, the mayor of Cumming, Ford Gravett, blamed the violence on outside agitators and said, quote, there's a very small minority resisting change, but 1% can start a riot. And there's also this other comment also from the documentary. This is Cox newspaper reporter Elliot Jaspin talking about the mindset of people in Forsyth. This is during the original purge in 1912.
The fable goes that, yes, there were unfortunate things that happened. Yes, some blacks were threatened, but we bought the land from those people who left. And so there really was no injury. And that's a very comforting story. It's not a true story, but it's a comforting story.
It's not a true story. And this is something you set out to confirm for your book. And you found it very difficult to find out what happened with the land. Where did you find records? What evidence did you find?
Yeah, you know, I looked at a lot of the same records that Elliot, he really blazed the trail on looking at this stuff as a journalist for the Austin Statesman and then in his book, Buried in the Bitter Waters. But yeah, in the records, you find several different outcomes. There were people who sold at very depressed prices. There are reports from The Crisis, the NAACP's magazine in 1915, documenting that many people had to accept lowball offers. And of course, they were in no position to negotiate since whites knew what was happening in the county. There were also people who held onto their land in hopes of weathering the storm. There was a property owner named Joseph Kellogg who owned 200 acres, and he held on for several years, hoping that he might be able to come back and then eventually sold. And then the third group, which is really the most troubling, is there were people who simply walked away. There's no record of any transaction. And then eventually their land lot numbers appear later on in other transactions with no explanation. And essentially someone at the county clerk's office overlooking the fact that this property is actually owned by someone else.
One of the things that you point out is the difference between what happened in Forsyth, how that was handled, and what happened in Hall County. Why do you make that comparison?
Well, I thought it provided a really interesting comparison because at the time, before Lake Lanier, before the dam created Lake Lanier, Hall County was just across the Chattahoochee River. So you have two counties, very, very similar, one on the west side of the Chattahoochee and one on the right side. And in 1912, in that fall, the same waves of night riding rocked Hall County as did Forsyth. The outcome, though, was very different. In Hall County, the very first night riders, among the very first, were pursued by the police. They were arrested. They were tried, convicted, and their names appeared on the front page of the newspapers in Gainesville. And so the sheriff of Hall County later told a reporter, he said, "We are going to crush this thing in its infancy." And that is exactly what happened. It's not that there was an attempt to do this, but the equal protection of the law was afforded to the black people of Forsyth, or to Hall County. Unlike in Forsyth, where there's no record of a single arrest, there's no record of the mechanisms of the law ever engaging to protect any of the black people of Forsyth, and none of the night riders or lynchers or any of the other people in Forsyth ever faced any legal consequences.
And you point out that, to your mind, this is huge hypocrisy, not only among law enforcement, but the state leaders, all the way up to the governor, had a chance to intervene. And you make the comparison to the way they pursued moonshiners as well. You're about to answer that.
Yeah, there was the federal district court judge was a guy named William Newman. And I went and looked, and his gigantic leather minute book is at the Georgia Archives in Morrow. And I went expecting to find at least a few responses from the federal judiciary, because the mayor of Cumming, lots of people, concerned citizens in Cumming, were writing to the governor and writing to this federal district judge asking for help. And what I found instead was just endless cases of prosecutions by the federal courts of moonshiners, often moonshiners in Forsyth County. So it reminded me of the war on drugs. There was this incredible distraction. Georgia had passed one of the earliest prohibition laws in the country in 1908. And so there was this real obsession with breaking up moonshine stills and arresting distillers. And at the same time, in the same place, there are these terrorist attacks against African Americans. And the governor and the federal judiciary really turned a deaf ear and a blind eye.
And it's not only that, but one of the unfortunate African American residents was attacked and lynched. And you went down to the county courthouse and found a piece of the rope from the noose they used.
That's right. It has disappeared around 1987. It disappeared, but I talked to a local man who showed me a photograph of this, and the story was widely known that until about 1987, if you went looking in the minute books for records of the cases, there were two teenage boys were tried and convicted in a real kangaroo court trial for the murder of this girl, this white woman, May Crow. And if you went looking until about 1987, the place in the minute book was marked with a piece of rope that was from the rope that was used to hang the two of them.
And before we leave the hanging of, because it ended up being three men that were killed. One of them was I guess, attacked right in the middle of the street and lynched there by a mob. The two that you're referring to were hung by law enforcement, actually, after a very speedy trial. So three people died. Is that the extent of the deaths that we know of?
That's the extent of the deaths that we know of, yes. And you mentioned Rob Edwards was dragged from the county jail. He was a 24-year-old field hand. He was dragged from the county jail, beaten with crowbars, and lynched from a telephone pole on the town square. And hundreds of people joined into this and fired shots into his corpse.
Patrick, I wanted to play another comment. After the 1987 peace march that went so badly, Oprah Winfrey, who at that point must have been at the very, early stages of her career, brought her show to Forsyth County. And I'll let you describe what appeared to be her reaction. But here's a comment from one man that she spoke to. He did not give his name.
I'm afraid of them coming to Forsyth County. I lived in Atlanta. I was born in Atlanta. And I go down there now and I see my neighborhood and my community, which was a nice community, a nice neighborhood, and now it's nothing but a rat-infested slum area because they don't care.
The they he's referring to is African Americans. How did Forsyth, even on into the modern age, enforce an all-white dictum?
Well, this is one of the things that I was really intrigued by writing the book, having grown up there, was this process. You know, there were plenty of places that experienced the same kind of violence as Forsyth in the Jim Crow era. And this was always something that was told to me as a kid as a kind of explanation. And people would say, well, that was just the way it was in those days. But there is something really extraordinary about Forsyth that this lasted. You know, I was there, I was a child there in the 70s and 80s. This lasted on into my lifetime. It wasn't that the purge had reemerged. It had never really ended. So it was still going on. One of the things I came to believe was that what made this possible was that the Knight Riders in 1912 succeeded. And so there was no one really left to dissent against this. There were no African American people there. And so the kids I grew up with had very, very little experience of Black people. Many of them had never been to Atlanta, even though it was 40 miles down the road. They were largely terrified. When Miguel Marcelli was shot in 1980, one of his neighbors was confronted by Marcelli's girlfriend, who was covered in blood and crawled out of an overturned car and came to her door asking for help. And the woman didn't answer the door. She said she was terrified. So they white people in the county, I think, were very, very ignorant of, and they had no contact with Black people, and they themselves were locked in this kind of isolated bubble that left them very terrified as the world changed around them.
I should mention that our latest Census Bureau figures, which are from 2015, show the counties almost still 85% white, and African Americans make up less than 4% of the residents of Forsyth County. Now, an interesting wrinkle is that your family actually, your family, you're white, your family decided to march with and participate in the protest march in 1987. And the reason I find this very interesting is that while everyone else came in on buses and then left, your family very visibly protested the segregation in Forsyth County and then walked back to your house or went back to your house in Forsyth County. What was that like?
Yeah, it was. This was a frightening time for us. And I should clarify, because a lot of people are familiar with the second march, which happened on January 24th, 87, which was 20,000 strong, televised all over the country. We were part of that as well. But the march that my parents participated in first was on January 17th, 87. And this was a line of only about 75 marchers. Most of them had come from the King Center. A very small handful of people were from inside the county. So you're absolutely right. When it was over, And the buses rolled, there were two chartered buses. And when they rolled down 400 back to Forsyth or back to Atlanta, my parents were, you know, had marched a ways from their car. And the sheriff of the county, Wesley Walraven, helped get them into a law enforcement vehicle that helped get them back to their car. And then they drove home. And you know, I'm sure my father double checked the locks that night. There was a certain amount of fear. And at that same moment, I had actually arrived. I was 16. So typical of a 16-year-old, I was late.
Of course you were.
I was late to meet my parents. And I ended up going to the county, to the square, to the county courthouse, where I expected to rendezvous with the march, hear Hosea Williams and other leaders giving a speech celebrating King Day and speaking out for brotherhood. Instead, at a certain point, I was shoulder to shoulder with a bunch of other young men, and I heard a loudspeaker click on, and someone screamed out, "Raise your hand if you love white power." And all around me, people raised their fists and started chanting white power. And this was the moment when I realized that I had stumbled my way not into a peace march, but into the Ku Klux Klan's victory celebration on the square. So all just to say, Oprah Winfrey, when she left from that taping, said there are a lot of white people in this community who are afraid as well. And I think she got that exactly right.
So you have written this book, and you're talking about a county in which there still is the myth that this trouble was caused by outside agitators. There still is the myth that Forsyth County remained white by chance, right? I mean, some people think that there was no intimidation.
That's right. In 1987, there was a commission that the governor, Joe Frank Harris, convened. And the white members of that commission from Forsyth actually wrote in their report to the governor that many of the black residents in 1912 had, quote, voluntarily relocated. They blamed the boll weevil, even though the boll weevil did not arrive in Georgia until 1915. They blamed voluntary relocation. So there was a lot of denial, and an African-American member of that same committee named Felker Ward wrote in a competing report, this was very telling, after a year of working together, almost a year, the biracial commission in Forsyth issued two reports, one white and one black. And Felker Ward, in the report from Atlanta civil rights leaders, wrote a very telling sentence where he said, "For too long in this county, silence has been interpreted as consent." And I think that really got to the heart of it, that there, not everyone in the county agreed with all of this, but they remained silent for generations.
And let's hear one last voice from that documentary, Banished. This is Charles Wiley talking about Forsyth.
My grandmother used to tell us all about the old homestead that was up in Forsyth County, which was strange to us because we always heard that there's no black people in Forsyth County. That's what we were always told. There used to be a saying. Yeah, we even as young kids heard, you know, don't let the sun go down on you in Forsyth County.
Do you worry about the response to you there in Forsyth County, that people who might be angry with the book you've just written?
Sure. You know, I know those people are out there, but I also have heard from a lot of people who were very happy that I wrote the book, who were relieved to have some of this. And, you know, when I was a kid growing up in Forsyth, I always wanted to go to the library and find the book that would tell the real story. And at a certain point, it dawned on me that nobody was going to write that book, and that perhaps I was positioned as someone who'd grown up there and who had this curiosity that maybe if I wanted to read that book, I was going to have to write it myself.
I guess we'll have to let you go because someone else is calling in there, Patrick.
I just took care of that. Sorry about that.
This is the dangers of connecting via Skype. Patrick Phillips is author of the new book, Blood at the Root. It is harrowing, and it is, you can't put it down. It's available now. Thank you so much, Patrick.
Hey, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
2016 is the centennial year of the Pulitzer Prize, and that honor has been given to dozens of people who are either from or living in Georgia. So we are talking to as many of them as we can. It's a series we call Pulitzer Peaches. Today's guest is journalist Randall Savage. He and reporter Jacqueline Crosby won the Pulitzer for specialized reporting in 1985. They helped reveal that athletes were receiving preferential treatment at the University of Georgia and Georgia Tech, and the investigation was published in the Macon Telegraph. Randall's now a political reporter at WMAZ in Macon and hosts the public affairs program Close Up. Randall, it's good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you.
So it appears as though there was kind of talk all around, and people assumed, everyone knew that athletes were getting special treatment at UGA and Georgia Tech, but you had a hard time tracking down the information. Did you really have to go around just grabbing people on campus and talking to them?
It was almost like that, yes. They had their official company line, in which they would say that athletes were not necessarily given preferential treatment, but they would be steered in directions where they would succeed. And we had reason to believe that that wasn't the whole truth. And so basically what we did is to get to the bottom of it, like for special courses, easy courses to take, we went over to McCorder Hall, where the athletes lived at that time. I don't know if they still do, but and we would corner some athletes, and we would ask them, where do you go when you had to have a passing course, a passing grade? And they named over several things, and we checked them out, and some of the professors actually admitted, yeah, this is an easy course.
So what you found were these developmental classes, and they were originally designed to help people who maybe weren't ready for college-level courses, first-generation students, perhaps. Who was using those developmental classes?
Developmental studies was created by the Board of Regents at about the time of integration. And it was designed to help students who were not quite prepared to undertake college-level courses. But it turns out that a good percentage of the people in the developmental studies program were athletes. At the time we were doing that, they had 322 students enrolled in developmental studies, and 75% of them were athletes. That was at UGA. And at Tech, they had 36 students in their developmental program, and 17 of them were athletes.
And you also reported on a story of a professor named Jan Kempf. In fact, it appears as though your story contributed to her success in a lawsuit. What happened with Jan Kempf?
Well, Jan Kempf was the English coordinator in the developmental studies program. And in 1981, a couple of teachers under her had declined to promote nine athletes, and it was right before a bowl game, and they would not have been eligible to have played in the bowl game. But the director of developmental studies overruled what the two teachers had said, that they were not eligible to go, and Jan Kempf took issue of it, and she was not fired on the spot, but her contract was not renewed, and she filed suit against the university and developmental studies and a couple of people involved in that program. And she successfully won that suit. I think it was in 1986 in federal court, where she was she got her job back with back pay and damages of like $1.2 or $1.3 million.
So when somebody first told you that they'd submitted your investigative reports for a Pulitzer, what did you think when they first said, hey, we're nominating you?
Well, I thought that was a nice gesture, but I didn't think it would win. I just didn't think it. I don't know. Maybe I had notions of grandeur for a Pulitzer, and I just didn't. To me, that thing was more drudgery than it was glamour, because it took so long to put it all together because we got so much resistance at UGA.
So when you actually won, I mean, you must have been surprised, first of all.
Yes. I was surprised. I knew that it had been submitted. I also knew it had passed the first round of the test and it was nominated for the finalists. But still, that was a long ways to go.
So what does winning a Pulitzer do? Does it change anything for you?
Well, it gives you a new name, like Pulitzer Prize winner.
True enough. Does it do anything else? Does it help you? Do people recognize your name when you're reporting with them? Does it help you get sources? Does it change your job?
In some ways, yes. Some people know that, and they would say he's a Pulitzer Prize winner, and they give a favorable nod, things like that. It changed somewhat in the job categories.
So now when you look back on that reporting from the 1980s, do you feel as though things have really changed? And do you feel as though you are kind of part of a catalyst toward change?
There were some changes made as a result of that. But as far as the overall situation with athletes today, I could not say what their status are now. I know the developmental studies program is no longer in existence, but they do have special programs for students who need some extra help. Jan Kempf, of course, got her job back, but As far as the overall program, I could not answer that because I have not done any research on it in several years.
All right. So you said you weren't sure why they submitted this particular one because it felt like drudgery to you. So what, before we go, tell me what story would you if you were going to choose over your career?
Oh, no question about it. The mass murderer, Paul John Knowles, who came, he had a girlfriend in Macon, and he went all over the country killing folks, and he'd always come back to Macon. And he eventually got caught, and he was brought back to Macon, and he had killed some people right before he was captured, and he used to tape record his killings. And those two people that he captured right before he was captured were still missing. And for 3 or 4 days there, they were trying to get information where they could be and this type of stuff. And he was in federal court, and he was in state court. And it was that was, to me, the thing that I thought probably should have been the best that we've ever done. And that was in 1974, the year of the Watergate. So Paul John Knowles, mass murderer, took a back seat.
Yeah, I bet. Although this is the worst time ever for me to say that we're out of time. My guest is journalist Randall Savage. He won the Pulitzer Prize for specialized reporting in 1985. His investigation, along with his colleague, exposed academic athletic abuses at the University of Georgia and at Georgia Tech. And as you've heard, he's reported on all kinds of other interesting things as well. Thank you so much, Randall.
Thank you.